The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the March 26th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Uncle Sam. He's looking out the window of, I guess it looks like a upstairs suburban bedroom or something like that. On the wall beside him are tally marks that just cover the whole wall. There's a couple of several different kind of masks hanging on the wall. The window's cracked open, and he's looking out onto a scene that there's a church in the foreground, city in the background. There's trees leafing out and in bloom and birds singing. Very bright scene, and the headline is, "The end is in sight. After a year of lockdowns, pain, and death, vaccines offer liberation by summer." And I think we see that topic several times. Firstly, in our first main story, Biden promises vaccine doses for all by May. What happened? Hopes grew this week that the end of the pandemic is in sight as the U.S. hit record numbers of daily vaccinations, and President Biden vowed to make doses available to every adult American by May. Nearly 6 million shots were administered over last weekend after a week in which an average 2.4 million shots were given daily, a 40% increase from early February. Some 30% of all American adults and two-thirds of those over 65 have now received at least one shot, and nearly 40 million Americans are fully vaccinated. In a primetime address last week, Biden promised that ramped-up production and the purchase of new doses would mean every adult could be inoculated by the end of May. With infection, death, and hospital rates steadily dropping, he said, if Americans remain vigilant, there's a good chance of returning to a semblance of normalcy by July 4th, with small gatherings of family and friends. That will make this Independence Day truly special, Biden said, where we not only mark our independence as a nation, but we begin to mark our independence from this virus. Alaska and Mississippi became the first states to open vaccination to all adults, as Connecticut and Michigan said they'd do likewise by April 5th, and Ohio opened eligibility to anyone 40 and older. "Get your shots, friends, and let's get back to normal," Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves exhorted on Twitter. But Mississippi was one of more than a dozen states that lifted nearly all restrictions, even as cases crept up in some states in the upper Midwest, Northeast, and Mid-Atlantic. Public health experts warn that as more contagious variants spread, another surge is possible if caution is abandoned. "This is not the time to let up," said Biden. What the editorial said: "How wonderful to have competent leadership," said the San Francisco Chronicle. Unlike his predecessor, Biden is willing to take responsibility for a national crisis and has reminded us what a newly sentient national government can achieve. The pandemic is not yet over, but thanks to the Biden administration's efforts to speed vaccine production and buy 800 million doses, the distance to that celebratory day is getting shorter. Biden's self-congratulatory speech felt like a con job, said the New York Post. He promised that people can gather outdoors with friends by July, but millions of Americans are already doing that. He made a big deal of upping the vaccine supply when that was hardwired in long before he took office. In his effort to portray himself as a savior, Biden sounded like he was trying to sell Americans a bridge they already own. What the columnist said: "Biden should give President Trump his due," said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Without Trump's bold Operation Warp Speed initiative, vaccine doses would not now be rolling out by the millions. Biden may have ramped up vaccine production and distribution, but he was building on Trump's undeniable important contributions. Instead of acknowledging that reality, he acts like he had to conjure the vaccines out of nowhere. We haven't forgotten what Trump gave us, said Frieda Gittes in CNN.com, an excruciating dystopian year in which 400,000 Americans died. Trump told Americans the virus was a little flu that was going away and callously ignored its casualties. In his moving, compassionate speech, Biden offered a stunning contrast, and his accelerated vaccine schedule showed he can deliver for a suffering nation. It's impossible not to wonder how many lives would have been saved if we'd had a reasonable, competent, stable president when the coronavirus struck. Herd immunity may already be kicking in, said David Linhart in the New York Times. Some scientists estimate that about 30% of Americans have been infected with the coronavirus, and about 30% have received at least one vaccine shot. There's overlap between the groups, but more than 40% now have some protection from COVID, so the virus has fewer people to infect. But as states rush to lift mask mandates and restrictions on indoor gatherings, the twin threats of risky behavior and new virus variants pose a continued danger. Remember, about 12,000 Americans died from COVID in the past week. Better days may be coming, but the crisis is still with us. Here's a short, it wasn't all bad piece. Last week, a group of people in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, got an extra dose of delight with their vaccines. Yo-Yo Ma, age 65, was waiting out the 15-minute observation time in a college gym after his second shot, and he had brought his cello. The world-renowned cellist began to play Schubert's Ave Maria and then Bach's Prelude in G minor while workers and the newly inoculated listened, rapt. Everybody just went quiet, said lead nurse Leslie Drager. Afterward, Ma stood and placed his hand on his heart while the group applauded and snapped photos. It just brought that whole room together, said nurse Hillary Bashara. It was so healing. Our controversy of the week is, 1 year on, how has the pandemic changed us? At this time in March a year ago, we realized everything was about to change, said Remy Tooman in NYTimes.com. As cases of COVID-19 spread, the World Health Organization declared a pandemic. Fear gripped us and normal life shut down. More than 540,000 Americans and 2.7 million people in total have died, and millions have lost their jobs and businesses. Far from being the great leveler that some predicted, the pandemic exacerbated the inequities of our society. While the office workers who began working from home on laptops and video calls were mostly white and relatively affluent, the essential workers who kept our hospitals, supermarkets, and our country running were disproportionately brown-skinned and lower income, and their communities were ravaged by the virus. With mass vaccinations now underway, we survivors are wondering what awaits at the end of this long, dark tunnel. There are so many questions, said Nicholas Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. How will a lost year of schooling and socialization affect our children? Will we ever go back to hugging and shaking hands? And with 42% of adults reporting struggles with anxiety and depression this year, how long before we work through the trauma of COVID and put it in the past? We'll never fully return to the way we used to live and work, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. When 42% of U.S. workers started working remotely a year ago, most found they were more productive. Coupled with a need for physical space, this spurred a mini exodus to the suburbs and rural areas, which may continue after offices reopen. Eventually, though, we'll strike a balance between remote work and the energizing in-person interaction of office life. A rethinking is underway in education, too, said Donna St. George in WashingtonPost.com. The pandemic showed unmistakably that most students learn best in person. But online learning provides a new tool to reach students who can't make it to the classroom or who want to take specialized classes in another district. Who is this we, said John Rash in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Previous crises, from World War II to 9/11, have created the feeling that we're all in this together. But this one has left us more divided than ever. Thanks to the erratic, divisive leadership of then-President Trump, nearly half the country refused to take the pandemic seriously. Millions still reject common sense measures like mask wearing as sinister incursions on their freedom. Even before the pandemic, we had a nation without a shared set of facts, said Elliot McLaughlin in CNN.com. This erosion of agreed upon truth dealt us deadly consequences during the pandemic and bodes ill for our handling of future crises. The immediate challenge is recovery from this one, said Jacob Stern in TheAtlantic.com. By its very nature, the pandemic is at once the most universal of disasters and the loneliest. Cooped up at home, we've had no choice but to inhabit our own realities and cope with very different kinds of loss and grief. The other psychological arch-villain here is uncertainty, said Matt Simon in Wired.com. We've been finding a new invisible enemy with guesswork and evolving science, and even now it's not clear when or if we'll reach herd immunity. Like returning soldiers from war, we may feel both haunted and grateful when we return to a new normal and never take it for granted again. Here's our good week, bad week feature. It was a good week for insurance after University of Arizona scientists proposed sending 335 million samples of sperm, eggs, and spore from humans and other species to the moon so these species could be regenerated. Earth, the scientists noted, is a naturally volatile environment. It was a good week for thinking out of the box after Tesla Incorporated informed the Securities and Exchange Commission that CEO Elon Musk now prefers a new title, Techno King. And it was a good week for spare tires after Dating.com found that 75% of singles prefer male partners with dad bod than any other body type. VP Maria Sullivan said people may find ideal superfit bodies attractive in the abstract, but that isn't always the case when it comes to real-life romances. But it was a bad week for not seeing the future after Wisconsin fire investigators blamed a house fire that caused an estimated $250,000 damage on the homeowner's crystal ball. When sunshine came through a large set of windows and through the glass ball, it ignited the couch, investigators concluded. It was a bad week for Miami, which was overrun with thousands of unruly spring breakers ignoring COVID restrictions, drinking in the street, blocking traffic, and jumping on car hoods to twerk. It's not worth the revenue, said exasperated Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber. Finally, it was a bad week for zero-interest financing. After Eric Warren, 50, of Texas, was sentenced to 20 years in jail for borrowing a loaner vehicle from a BMW dealership, using the car for armed bank robbery, and returning to the dealer to buy a car with cash. The title of our briefing page article is America's Falling Fertility Rate. Women are having fewer children than at any time on record. What are the implications? What is the current rate? The U.S.'s total fertility rate, or the number of babies each woman is expected to have during her lifetime, reached a record low of 1.705 births per woman in 2019, the latest year for which data is available. That year, the number of babies born in the U.S. was 3.74 million, a 35-year low. The dramatic drop in births mirrors a worldwide trend. Britain, Canada, France, and Australia all had fertility rates below 1.9 in 2018, below the replacement rate of 2.1 needed to sustain their populations. Some experts are calling this phenomenon a demographic time bomb. In coming years, lower fertility rates could have profound economic consequences, with employers lacking sufficient workers to grow the economy. And with fewer young workers paying into Social Security and Medicare, these safety net programs will be in trouble. In the early 1980s, the U.S. had about five workers providing the taxes to support each retired beneficiary. By 2019, the Social Security Administration says that ratio had declined to 2.8 workers per retiree, and by 2035, it may drop to 2.2 workers per beneficiary. It's a crisis, said Dowell Myers, a University of Southern California demographer. We need to have enough working-age people to carry the load of these seniors. Why the decline in births? A complex set of factors has driven down birth rates for almost all age groups of women, except for those in their late 30s and early 40s. As more women pursue college and advanced degrees and devote their 20s to career building, the mean age at which women had their first birth reached a record high of 26.9 in 2018. The Census Bureau reported that from 2000 to 2019, the number of 25-year-olds who had obtained a master's degree doubled to 21 million, and the number of those pursuing doctorates more than doubled. In a 2020 survey of thousands of women who delayed childbirth, 3 in 5 cited their desire to reach a certain job title or level before starting a family. Many feminists say this is necessary because many employers sideline mothers. Ashley Stahl, a career coach, points to a Princeton University study showing that for every child a woman has, her earnings potential falls 4%. What role does housing play? A major one. The National Bureau of Economic Research says that the largest component of child-rearing cost is housing, and the cost of housing in America has skyrocketed. The median U.S. home in 1953 cost $18,080, or about $177,000 in today's inflation-adjusted dollars. Today, the median home price is $301,000. Young people who cannot afford homes or even a two-bedroom apartment are less inclined to marry and to have children. One 2014 study published in the Journal of Public Economics explicitly linked housing cost to fertility, suggesting that for every $10,000 jump in housing values, fertility among non-owners fell 2.4%. Economists also point to the fact that the fertility rate has fallen every year since 2007, and suggests that the Great Recession compelled many millennials to put off child-rearing for years. What we learned from the Great Recession is that every 1 percentage point increase in the unemployment rate reduces births by 1%, said Wellesley College economics professor Phil Levine. What about teenage births? The number of teen births has plunged from 41.5 children per 1,000 women in 2007 to 17.4 per 1,000 women in 2018. Studies have attributed this rapid decline to improved access to birth control, especially highly effective means such as the pill, IUDs, and implants. The Medicaid expansion and keeping young people on their parents' insurance has really been important for young people to access contraception, said Elise Berlin of the Young Woman's Contraceptive Services Program at the Nationwide Children's Hospital. Did the pandemic affect births? It is apparently causing a baby bust. Researchers Melissa S. Kearney and Philip B. Levine estimate that the pandemic will result in 300,000 to 500,000 fewer babies born in the U.S. Lockdowns and fear kept young people from meeting and marrying, and the economic hardship discouraged many young couples from having kids. Among the 32 states that had annual data available, there were about 95,000 fewer births in 2020 compared with the prior year, a decline of roughly 4.4%. Meanwhile, a Guttmacher Institute survey showed that as a result of the pandemic, 34% of American women have either put off plans to have children or reduced the number they expect to have. There may be a rebound when the pandemic ends, but Guttmacher research scientist Laura Lindberg said the shock and chronic uncertainty of the last year will linger. Until people feel more confident about the economy and the state of the world, she said, concerns about having children are going to continue. Government childbirth programs. Nearly 30% of the world's countries have officially adopted pro-natalist policies to encourage their citizens to have kids. Hungary, which saw its fertility rate reach an all-time low of 1.23 in 2011, is spending 5% of GDP on policies such as free treatment cycles at nationalized IVF clinics for women under 40, upfront loans to newlyweds that can be written off with each birth, and even a lifetime exclusion from income tax for moms with three or more kids. Poland is giving moms about $140 per child per month. Russia is giving parents with two or more children one-off payments of about $8,100. And South Korea has spent $130 billion on a similar program since 2006. Evidence suggests, however, that these payments produce mostly short-term gains in fertility. Women have children earlier, but not more of them. In Alaska, where residents' share of oil revenues is based on the number of kids they have, the long-term gains in fertility were negligible. Single policy measures are unlikely to increase fertility, said researchers from the Wittgenstein Center, a Vienna-based group that studies population dynamics. High-equality public daycare, research shows, is the only policy that leads to significant increases in the number of babies women choose to have. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First one comes from the U.S. Daylight saving time is a problem we shouldn't fix, said Benjamin Applebaum. Most people gripe when setting back their clocks and losing an hour every spring, as we did last week. New legislation introduced by Senator Marco Rubio would address this irritation by making the daylight saving time, DST, permanent. But of our three imperfect alternatives, permanent DST, permanent standard time, ST, and our current combination, the status quo remains the best available compromise. Daylight saving time was designed to align the hours of daylight with the hours that people are awake, particularly in the summer. Permanent DST would mean that during the winter months, the sun wouldn't rise in many cities before 8:30 or 9 a.m., forcing people to commute to work or school in nighttime darkness. During the 1974 oil crisis, Congress moved the country onto permanent DST for 2 years, but an angry backlash over dark winter mornings ended that experiment after one. Permanent standard time, on the other hand, would mean hours of wasted sunshine on summer mornings with earlier summer sunsets. Yes, changing the clocks can have sleep and health costs, but 8 months of getting an extra hour of sunshine while we're awake is better than the alternatives. These two columns come from Europe. First is race, still matters in translation. The appointment and then recusal of a white poet to translate Amanda Gorman's work has sparked a firestorm of outrage in the Netherlands, said Marissa Monsanto. Gorman, a 23-year-old African-American poet, won international acclaim for her reading of an original spoken word piece at President Biden's inauguration. But to translate that work into Dutch, the publisher picked Marieke Lucas Rinveld, the winner of last year's International Booker Prize. Rinveld, who is non-binary and uses the pronouns them, there, is an unbelievably great talent. But the 29-year-old does not know the spoken word genre and admits their command of English is poor. When black journalist Janice Duhl pointed this out and urged the hiring of a qualified black translator, Rinveld quit and conservatives began to howl. Race, they said, should not be an issue in literary translation. Yet with a poem such as Gorman's, which invokes America's racial struggles, surely some familiarity with such struggles would be pertinent. People of color are underrepresented in the literary world. To give such a coveted gig to the most famous white poet of the moment suggests that the publisher wasn't much interested in a faithful rendition. As for all those griping about the supposed anti-white discrimination, do you ever raise your voice in protest discrimination against Dutch people of color? This is from Germany. Biden is no more generous than Trump. Call it America First 2.0, said Klaus-Dieter Frankenberger. President Biden is so determined that 100 million Americans be inoculated against COVID within his first 100 days in office that he signed an executive order upholding the ban on vaccine exports put in place by former President Trump. No vaccines manufactured in the U.S. are to be sent abroad, not even a single shot from its 30 million dose stockpile of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which was developed by Oxford University scientists and has yet to be approved for use in America. Meanwhile, Johnson & Johnson's vaccine, which the European Union advance purchased in bulk, will not be delivered to us in the agreed quantity for many months. Is the U.S. so desperate for shots? No, it has a surplus. Biden just ordered another 100 million Johnson & Johnson doses, which means it will have enough vaccine from approved suppliers to fully inoculate 500 million people, 170 million more than live in the U.S., by the end of the summer. This selfishness leaves the EU, which has been struggling with shortages and manufacturing glitches, out in the cold. And now individual European leaders are letting China and Russia exploit the vaccine gap politically. The export ban has proved it doesn't matter who is president. Instead of supporting allies, America would rather say, every man for himself. The last word, our feature article, also deals with the anniversary of the pandemic. The title is 1 Year of Isolation. At the anniversary of the pandemic, said the Washington Post, we have all had to get used to living apart. These are some of the stories of a year in which travel, school, ceremonies, and even touch disappeared. The 8-year-old, why have a 9th birthday when you never really got to be 8? Emily Garcia's parents went all out for her 8th birthday celebration. Extra decorations, tons of balloons, a shiny unicorn crown. Amelia barely noticed. What good is a kid's birthday party without other kids? What good is it to even be a kid without other kids? For the past 12 months, Amelia, who lives in Tracy, California, has not stepped foot on a playground. She's attended no sleepovers, no camps, no Girl Scout meetings, no school concerts, no Santa visits at the mall. She has not seen her very best friend in the whole wide world, Yulheimi, since the day they left school in a hurry. And you know what? Eight-year-olds don't have phones. Emilia can't stay in touch. Yulheimi is just gone. Here are the things that frighten Emilia the most. Zombies and Kermit. The frog is creepy, she insists. And to Emilia, this whole coronavirus thing feels like a zombie attack where you can't see the zombies. But she knows the danger is out there. It sent everyone fleeing to their homes, hiding their faces with masks. It took away her friends. Emilia has a six-year-old brother, Benicio, and thank God for him. At least she has someone to play with, even if he is a little brother. Emilia also sees a few aunts and uncles, some older cousins, and her mom's mom. But that's it. And grown-ups don't cut it in Amelia's book. Something's wrong with their imaginations, she thinks. They like to be quiet, not crazy. They can never quite convince themselves that the floor actually is lava. Usually at Halloween, there is a costume parade at school and trick-or-treating at the shops downtown. This year, there was nothing. Usually for Dia de los Muertos, Emilia's mom organizes a celebration and art show. This year, there was nothing. Usually in December, Emilia spends Christmas Eve with her paternal grandparents. This year, they didn't go. Emilia has seen them twice. Both times she stood outside their home and waved through a window. That was written by Ellen McCarthy. The 102-year-old. When every year could be his last, he just wants to see people. Melvin was born in 1918, just as influenza ripped through the United States. Raised in Portland, Oregon, he served in Italy during World War II, met and married a nice girl named Edna, and settled in Pittsburgh, where he worked as an electrical engineer, and they raised two sons. Now he lives in the skilled nursing wing of an assisted living facility called Sherwood Oaks, which has been kept under various degrees of lockdown since March 2020. His whole world has been his room. Abstract paintings by Edna, who succumbed to Alzheimer's in 2004. Photographs of his five adult grandchildren, who are acutely aware they should call him more often. His hearing is bad, and sometimes he has trouble with his eyes, but he is otherwise in good health for someone who is 102. He got both doses of the vaccine last month. I've survived two pandemics, and I haven't been sick at all, he says. So I just don't understand why I can't go out for, say, an hour. But the state has a restriction. Visitors are now allowed, but it's complicated, his elder son, Jim, says. They must be scheduled in advance, but whenever a nurse reports an exposure, the whole place goes under lockdown for 2 weeks, and visits are canceled. He used to see his father every couple of days for lunch, but now he gets less than an hour, masked and distanced, whenever he can. Melvin doesn't see much of the other residents either. Skilled nursing inhabitants have breakfast and lunch together in the dining room, but everyone is at least 6 feet apart. It's not exactly the best situation to carry on a conversation, he says. Other times are spent mostly in the reclining chair by the window, mostly alone. I spend a lot of time thinking about Edna, he says. And I don't know if I'm lonely or not, but there's no one around to talk to, so I have no choice. When you are 102, a virus is just one of the things that could kill you. When you are 102, when every year could be your last, you don't want to spend it alone in your chair, surrounded by pictures instead of people. I really miss all of you, he tells his interviewer. We miss you too, I say. Melvin is my grandfather. That was written by Mara Judkus. The massage therapist. Navigating a year without touch when people need it most. Jen Williams' hands are slight yet mighty, her gift and livelihood. For months, they remained largely idle. Trained as a dancer, she's been a massage therapist for 23 years, first in Manhattan, then Philadelphia. The Pennsylvania Ballet and Drexel University swim team were among her clients. Williams no longer tends to the swimmers' sore shoulders, the dancers' aching everything. The swimmers are not competing. The dancers continue practicing, but the ballet quashed the nutcracker and is only now resuming virtual performances. But other people are elated to see Williams now. They're chattier, too. They tend to leave her table lighter, less burdened. "It's an honor that people trust me to come into my space," Williams says. "They put themselves in a very vulnerable position, even more so with COVID, and allow me to help them heal." Clients tell her that they're desperate to be touched, which is something Williams didn't hear pre-pandemic. Such is the power of touch in a world without handshakes or hugs. Williams fervently believes we need touch to survive and wither without it. This is our way of bonding without words. In July, after the initial shutdown ended, the first person on her table, a single woman in her 60s, ended the session in a puddle of tears. "No one has touched me in months. Not a handshake, not a hug, not an exchange of coins since March," the client said. "People cry all the time when they come to see me," said Williams, 47. "They have a little easier time crying since all this." That piece was written by Karen Heller. The Engaged. Delayed weddings are turning into delayed families. Sonia Forbes and Tyler Grady always knew they'd have a long engagement. When Tyler proposed in 2016 on campus at their alma mater, the University of California at San Diego, with a fire opal ring and a rewritten Weird Al Yankovic song, they were both 25. Sonia was about to move away across the country for grad school. But once they were in the same place again and financially stable enough, the two decided they would start planning a wedding. After marriage, they would promptly buy a house and start a family. Their plans came together for an October 2020 celebration at a secluded ranch in Los Gatos, California. They may as well have asked their 80 guests to save the 12th of never. "We knew when we got engaged that it was going to be a bit, but we weren't expecting it to be..." Tyler's voice trails off as he tries to do the math, calculating the distance between their engagement and when the wedding might eventually happen. Ugh. Marriage, in all its centuries as a staunch and stodgy cornerstone of human social tradition, has probably never taken a hit like the one it took last year. As wedding dates have been pushed back, the institution itself, the wedded bliss part, strains against the realities of pandemic confinement. Why not scrap the big wedding and move on with their lives? Certainly, they've thought about it. It could be a great story, even we live in Las Vegas. We could just drive down the strip and go get married there, she says. Still, letting go of a dream wedding isn't as simple as canceling a party. "I want to move into that next phase of our life with everyone we love around us," Sonia says. "Especially now that none of their friends have seen one another for a year. They want to hug and laugh and dance. They simply want to have a wedding and then try for a baby. It didn't used to be too much to ask." That was written by Ashley Fetters. The DJ, she's still spinning, minus the crowd. Green tea, morning yoga, Bose headphones. They cancel noise, but there's not much these days to cancel. The whine of her treadmill, maybe, or the thuds and murmurs of apartment life in Macomb County, Michigan. What was it like before? A purple beam of light slicing the fog, a bass line coming up through the floor, conjured by her fingers, shaking her gut, congregants moving at her command in a massive haze of breath and sweat. elbows kissing elbows, eyes meeting from 20 feet, and arm's length, inches, all those limbic things that have gone away. I miss the closeness of the crowd, she says. After 18 years at General Motors, there was a round of cuts. Fine. She would focus on music, which had already been her life for 30 years. Since those days, clubbing at the Music Institute in downtown Detroit. As DJ Minx, she had already launched her own record label, formed her own DJ collective, earned her spot on the 20 women who shaped the history of dance music. On her calendar about a year ago, New York, Denver, San Francisco, her last memory, screaming when Carl Craig sprung Prince's sex shooter at his 12-hour Detroit love party at Marble Bar. She took the tables after him at 11 p.m., straddling Friday and Saturday with a sonic sermon of house music. She loved to read a crowd. She loved to move a crowd, make them jump, take them deep, control and abandon simultaneously. She has, like DJs worldwide, streamed her sets. At Marble Bar, she's spun to no one but a video camera and artfully arranged mannequins, inert and expressionless. She knows people are out there listening, but I don't know who's looking at me, and I definitely cannot see them, so I can't feel what I used to. Her home setup is in her second bedroom. Sometimes Jewel the cat will hop on the turntables to remind her that we're all dancing at home alone. She pictures the island of Ibiza out there in the Mediterranean, a rooftop party by the water just after sundown. Everybody's there. Close your eyes, cancel the silence, and pretend. That was written by Dan Zack. The chaplain, masked at a hospice, he can no longer listen with his face. Alex Mareschi has a difficult job. As hospice care chaplain, he comforts the dying, easing their fears and anxieties during an incredibly vulnerable and frightening time. Surrounded by loss every day, the 32-year-old Episcopal minister has been humbled. Something changes about you when you can sit and hold hands with people that are dying, Mareschi says. It just changes you. It changed my need and compulsion to try to fix things. It changed my desire to make things better, my desire to fill in the silence with noise. Last spring, the virus hit his hometown of Albany, Georgia, like a bomb. Hospitals became overwhelmed and bodies piled up in freezer trailers, and Mareschi faced a challenge, offering comfort and compassion at a distance through a mask and a pane of glass. He tried to do his best. For some patients, it is enough for the chaplain to simply spend an hour in a room grieving in silence, to lay eyes on the dying while their family members grieve. In that silence, God is present too. The virus and the devastation it has caused are not evidence of an angry or capricious creator. Mareschi does not think of God as a giant person in the sky playing chess with human lives. God doesn't solely exist in peaks and miracles and laughter. In times of suffering and tears and heartache, God is close. Even when we are separated from one another by barriers of glass and fabric. That was written by Clyde McGrady. And a version of this article originally appeared in the Washington Post. Got a couple of pieces from the Health and Science page today. Starting with no symptoms, then long COVID. Up to a third of people suffering from long COVID, the lingering sickness that can last for months following an infection, may not have displayed any symptoms when they first tested positive for the coronavirus, a new study has found. Researchers examined the records of nearly 1,500 people in California who had a positive test result. 2 months after their infections, more than a quarter still had post-COVID symptoms such as shortness of breath, cough, fatigue, and chest pain. And of that group, 32% had shown no COVID symptoms in the first 10 days after initially testing positive. The study, which has yet to be peer-reviewed, found that every age group was afflicted by long COVID, including children. Co-author Melissa Pinto from the University of California, Irvine, says further research is needed. Symptoms can change from day to day, she tells the New York Times. One day they may have chest pain and a headache, and the very next day the chest pain and headache are gone, and they have backache and muscle aches. The self-decapitating slug. Scientists in Japan have discovered that two species of sea slug have the ability to decapitate themselves and then regrow an entire new body. The process of shedding a body part, known as autotomy, is relatively common in the animal kingdom. Many lizards can drop a still wiggling tail and distract a predator. But this is the first evidence of a creature jettisoning its entire body. The behavior was first observed by Sayaya Mito of Nara Women's University, who noticed that one of her lab's captive sea slugs had somehow been decapitated and that the head continued to move and munch algae. It was unbelievable, Mito told LiveScience.com. Her team monitored members of two species through their life cycle and found that while not all performed autotomy, many did, some doing it twice. The heart and other organs regenerated within a week, and after 3 weeks, most slugs had grown a new body. The researchers think the heads stay alive by using energy from the photosynthesis taking place in cells they've acquired from algae. They say the slugs likely perform autotomy to get rid of a parasite in their body. And we'll go ahead and turn over to the Talking Points page, starting with an article titled "The Rescue Bill, A New Era of Much Bigger Government." With his sprawling $1.9 trillion stimulus package, President Biden is leading a quiet revolution, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. 40 years ago, Ronald Reagan inaugurated a new ideological era built on tax cuts, supply-side economics, and a core conviction, Reagan summarized thusly, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. With the most progressive legislation since the 1960s, Biden is ushering in a new era built on precisely the opposite view. With the pandemic inflicting far deeper pain on working class and poor Americans and turning income inequality into a life or death proposition, Democrats are embracing the belief that only active and competent government can get us out of the mess we're in now. The mammoth rescue package spends tens of billions on health care subsidies, rental assistance, child tax credits, and direct payments to hundreds of millions of Americans. Say goodbye to trickle-down economics, said Sarah Jones in NYMag.com. Instead of cutting taxes for the richest and corporations, as Republicans did in their $1.9 trillion tax cut in 2017, Biden is going all in on the reverse bet. Lift households out of poverty, and they'll have more to spend. His package's benefits are heavily targeted toward the bottom 40%, such as a child tax credit that for most American parents will yield annual payments of $3,000 to $3,600 per child. For a party that cries socialism at the drop of a hat, said Matt Lewis in thedailybeast.com, the GOP had very little to say about this massive giveaway. The party used to be based on a limited government worldview, and that belief has earned success and hard work give us meaning and purpose. But during the Trump administration, many of my fellow conservatives threw their principles out the window, replacing them with a MAGA cult of personality and a nonstop culture war. So while Democrats and Biden were lurching toward socialism, Fox News and right-wing media were fixated on Dr. Seuss, Mr. Potato Head, and owning the libs. Traditional conservative beliefs, meanwhile, are fading away with hardly any defense. That deficits do matter. That there's no such thing as a free lunch. As a centrist Democrat, Biden used to espouse some of these views himself, said Joan Walsh in TheNation.com. When he first ran for president in 1988, he declared that a government subsidy is not the ultimate answer to the problems of the poor, and even cited Reagan's welfare queen example. As a senator, Biden voted for President Clinton's 1996 welfare reform bill, but a mismanaged plague that has killed 530,000 of us in a single year and badly damaged the economy has accelerated a leftward surge among Democrats, Biden included. The whole paradigm of the role of government in American life is shifting, said David Brooks in the New York Times, and not just because of the pandemic. For years, the up-by-your-bootstraps mentality touted by conservatives has rung hollow for millennials and Gen Z, who are increasingly worse off than their parents. They no longer trust in education and hard work as a ticket to economic security. Income inequality and the economic precarity are the problems of our time. By addressing those problems, Biden's bill gives Democrats a potent political weapon, said Jeff Greenfield in Politico.com. They may have found a tool to reconnect with working and middle-class voters whose loyalty has been threatened for well over half a century, and who turned to Trump in large numbers in 2016. The rescue bill is an unapologetic assertion of the power of government to help people, and because it benefits so many Americans, restaurant workers, small business owners, the self-insured, working parents, it's not based on identity politics. Still, the risks of so much spending are enormous, said Gerald Seeb in the Wall Street Journal. Biden and the Democrats are revolutionizing government with borrowed money and no Republican support in Congress. Democrats will own the consequences. What if the flood of federal money begins to ramp up inflation and frighten financial markets, also wary of tax hikes? You know what comes next, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is already putting tax hikes on the table, including higher tax rates for corporations, capital gains, and dividend payments, as well as a global minimum tax on corporations. There will be debate about which taxpayers to gore to pay for all this spending, but one sure bet is that the result won't be as popular as passing out money. Paying the bill never is. After the shot, what can you safely do? Americans just got their first glimpse of what life will be like after vaccination, said Lena Sun and Lenny Bernstein in the Washington Post. In new guidelines, the CDC said last week that those who have gone at least 2 weeks since their final dose can visit in small numbers at private indoor gatherings, such as dinner parties, without masking or social distancing. The CDC also said the inoculated can visit indoors with members of a single unvaccinated household without precautions, so long as the unvaccinated are not at high risk for serious illness. For now, the CDC said the vaccinated should continue masking in indoor public places and avoid long-distance travel. The guidelines are good news for grandparents, said Roni Karen Rabin in the New York Times. The CDC guidance means that they can now visit and hug their children and grandkids so long as their families are local. Actually, parts of the new guidelines are absurdly restrictive, said the Wall Street Journal. The CDC still isn't acknowledging the growing evidence that vaccinated people have a very low risk of passing the virus to the unvaccinated. A study from Pfizer and Israeli Health Ministry showed that vaccination diminishes transmission by up to 94%. With nearly 100% protection from serious illness and death, the vaccinated are essentially bulletproof, yet the CDC is still warning them against restaurants and air travel. Why? The CDC missed a critical opportunity, said Dr. Lena Wynn. With millions of Americans hesitant to get the vaccine, the agency needs to convince them that the shots are a ticket back to pre-pandemic life. But by insisting that the inoculated still abstain from traveling or from returning to gyms, salons, and churches, even while wearing masks, the CDC failed to give them the incentive to overcome their reluctance to get a shot. Soon the debate will shift, said the Los Angeles Times in an editorial. Should society mandate vaccinations for those returning to offices, planes, and other public spaces? Public health laws do allow the state and private employers to require vaccinations, but since the U.S. vaccines were approved under emergency use authorizations, it's unclear whether people can be required to get them. Cities, states, and Congress may have to make that decision. Lawmakers, it's your call. And we will finish out today's show with a quote from Whoopi Goldberg, quoted in thecut.com. And she says, appropriately, "The best advice on aging is this: what's the alternative?" And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And we thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.